All right. Let me do the opening here. Welcome to the Labor Beat Radio program, broadcasting on the Enlightened Radio Network, www.enlightenedradio.org. That's where you can see our blog we have there. We also have there's a player at the top of that page. And if you want to go just to the players, for example, on your cell phone or smartphone or whatever, then you want to probably use player.enlightenedradio.org, since sometimes the player doesn't appear on the small screens on the www site. And also we have a list of our podcasts, but going back several years, on a number of different shows we broadcast here at podcasts.enlightenedradio.org. And welcome. I want to welcome Jonah and Billy and perhaps some others that are going to come on the program here. We're talking about Truckers for Justice. Is that correct? And
Truckers Movement
for Justice. And this is a rank and file effort in the trucking industry. Unlike most other industries, there's a lot of unbelievable pressure on working people, families, jobs. During the pandemic, I can't even start with the number of stories that we've heard of the what's happening on the job and what happened when, the pressure lifted and the company's promises of better pay and conditions were ended up as just empty bullshit, I guess be the best word. And so I'm really excited that we have an opportunity to talk to a rank and file movement among the truckers. There's movements like this going on everywhere. I want to start out the first question and ask either Jonah or Billy to, on the record here, we've been talking about it a little bit earlier, on the record to tell us what Truckers Movement for Justice is, and we'll take it from there. Either one of you, who wants to open up?
Okay. Jonah, if it's all right, I'll take that one. Truckers Movement for Justice is a dream. It's a vision. It's a vision of an industry-wide movement of rank-and-file company drivers, owner-operators, and small carriers united to take back power in the industry and to change the industry once and for all to make it what it once was. A good place to work, hard work, mind you, many, many hours away from home and family and friends, but yet an environment where you could provide a good living for yourself, your family, and your community where you're from. It's no longer like that. It is a race to the bottom. The arrogance and corruption in the industry from the top to the bottom, and using political puppets of whatever stripe you want at any given time to control and push down drivers. There was a statement made by the industry not long ago that in 1980, at the onset of deregulation and subsequent re-regulation, truck drivers' average annual wages were $80,000 a year. Admittedly, wages had fallen to $47,000 or less in many cases a year. The words of many drivers come to my mind, but I'll use the quote I always use. I can't feed my family, my children, and I own my own truck. From a brother during a strike in Port of Siegert in Baltimore, Maryland last August, waged by drivers under TMJ's leadership. That's something that cuts to the bone, pain of those words. TMJ organizes the old-fashioned way, one driver at a time, one area at a time. We were the only rank-and-file truck drivers ever invited to the White House for a largely ceremonial event. The government doesn't like us. The industry certainly doesn't like us. But drivers are now coming together since the war began leading up to May 1st in the protest in D.C. staged by TMJ. And drivers are now across the country coming out of the bushes and asking, what should we do? How can we do it? When do we do it? There's an old quote from the late civil rights leader, John Lewis. If not now, then when? If not us, then who? We say it's now, we say it's us, and the war has begun.
The truck I see most on the road around here in this part of West Virginia, which is Jefferson County, are Amazon trucks. And do you have any connections with the people in Amazon?
Yes, we do. Yeah, the drivers who are pulling under contract to Amazon, be they out of West Virginia or Pennsylvania or any of the places, are we have some initial contacts with drivers in New Orleans from Amazon and Pittsburgh. Very few by and large. Amazon's not an initial target, although I do know that some of the Amazon organizing has encompassed truck drivers as well, mostly the package delivery, the final mile drivers.
Right.
Not necessarily the over-the-road drivers that are running from Amazon's, entitlement centers or whatever they're called, the big warehouses.
Fulfillment centers.
Fulfillment centers. Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
Those drivers we have not reached out to yet. We're targeting at this point four specific states, all right, for various strike action, demonstrations, protests, whatever you want to call them. I can't tell you what states.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, no, that's fair.
You know, and I can't tell you what the strategy and the targets are either. No. But we've targeted four specific states leading up to May 1st and continuing along those lines and disrupt the economy. It's going to be this guerrilla warfare tactics. We'll strike 1 or 2 days, we'll run back into the bushes. The power of the industry is enough that it could crush us in a heartbeat. The only way to fight back until we get strong enough is through guerrilla warfare, and that's what we intend to use. Jonah, jump in, please.
Yeah, Jonah.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything specific. I guess I can speak from personal experience that I am a log truck driver currently in southern West Virginia. Outside of Beckley, trying to set up a small timber company with a buddy of mine out in McDowell County. And we've been drawn towards TMJ for all the same reasons that Billy has said. I mean, we're the timber industry drivers all across the country, but especially in this state, are crippled by the boom and bust structure of the extractive industry, especially timber, where there's such big consolidation that it's impossible to make a living, especially when the price of timber plummets. And we found right now, especially, that there's kind of a disconnect where most drivers are owner operators or small company drivers without much bargaining power. And most finished product, the lumber vendors are gouging the prices of timber at an all-time high for finished product, and yet the price of raw timber is at an all-time low. And that's what these buyers, these log buyers, are using to justify paying poverty wages that you can't actually earn anything from. And many people I've talked to, I used to work up in Clay County driving for a logging company up there. Then I was out in Raleigh County, and now we were kind of doing an owner-op on our own. And so many people say that a large part of that is because of the market consolidation, not just on the part of raw timber buyers and mill processors such as Weyerhaeuser and some of the other big, we've got a lot of Appalachian wood products down here, but also the vendors. I mean, this is Lowe's and Home Depot at a certain point here. And then you look at the actual percentage that's going to the truck driver, and even some of the other blue collar labor farther down the supply chain. And it's just not enough to make a living at this point. And so much of that has to do with a lack of bargaining power. And that's really what's drawn us to the appeal of Truckers Movement for Justice, while also trying to try out this new cooperative model such that hopefully the folks doing the work can actually get a more of a fair shake.
Will banks
compensation for their labor?
Will a bank loan money to a cooperative?
There are banks, there are financial institutions that are available to work with small startup cooperatives. We're based in North Carolina, Hollywood and I. So we, we've spoken with a cooperative, a worker cooperative organization down there periodically to discuss that. And there are, and I think, Joni, you mentioned you've got resources up in West Virginia area as well.
Yeah, I mean, banks will loan to cooperatives if they look financially viable. That's the worker organization structure at a certain point is kind of moot. If you have a business model that looks profitable,
yeah,
and a product that's in demand, the problem we've found is because we want to be more of a, our philosophy is that we really want to help the low-income citizens of McDowell County who can't afford lumber to fix their houses. There's a lot of deteriorating homes. That area of the coal fields is so depressed that it's hard to get a bank loan, even if you're just a conventional business, right, unless you already have a track record of years of operation. So we found it isn't really the business organization structure that's the barrier to getting a loan. It's really that banks don't want to invest in economically depressed areas. So we've had to kind of branch out towards other sources of funding. We've been working with the Beckley Hive, which is a business incubator venture from the New River Gorge Development Authority, which is basically the Southern West Virginia branch of the Appalachian Regional Commission. There's another really cool cooperative, like, I guess, startup fund here in Charleston called New Economy Works. We've been in contact with some co-op development folks at Ohio State University. So there's funding avenues available, but in terms of conventional bank loans, it's real tough to get funding in Southern West Virginia unless you already have years of business operation and can already kind of have a proven track record.
Do you have any need, use? I mean, I have a brother-in-law, for example, that he was a trucker for years. His family was truckers too, and then he got a business degree at some college at some point. He came back and he set up a brokerage, you know, where he was helping backfill. You know, someone went out to the West Coast and then they wanted a load to get back. They would call this broker and they'd arrange for a load to come back so they wouldn't have to come back empty. And he turned that into a fairly good family business, actually, doing that. Is that kind of networking still a factor, or do the big companies do all that on their own? Or is there a
the freight brokers have literally taken over the industry in terms of shipments. The large shippers and even small shippers, you are using the freight brokers more and more, especially over the road and regional, any kind of long haul work. And that's actually the freight brokers are one of the targets of TMJ's organizing, because what they've done is circumvent federal law by refusing to, by forcing drivers and owner ops to waive their rights under federal law to see what's known as the shipper's bill of freight, as well as to be paid for all of their hours. that they work on the clock, but the wheels are not moving because they're loading and unloading. Give you an example. On any given day, truck drivers that work intermodal and drayage, which are the ports, as well as over the road, will sit anywhere from 1 to 2, 6 hours, even a dozen hours a day at loading docks and facilities to shippers and receivers. They won't be paid for that time.
Right.
They're not paid for waiting time. They're paid when the wheels are moving, whether they're company drivers in some cases or whether they're owner ops in small carriers.
Mm-hmm.
Waiving our rights and having us work for free harkens again back to sharecropping.
Gotcha.
All right, when you worked all year and you brought your harvest in to the boss man, and boss man told you you had a great year, Joe. They only owe me $2,000. Tell your missus to credit to it.
Jeez. Oh, man.
And you're going to have a better year next year. I feel it.
I feel
and
it.
And Joe feels real happy. Boss man liked what he did. Goes home to his wife, and his wife says, sweetheart, did we do good? Yes, ma'am, we did. Boss man said we only owe him $2,000. You didn't get paid?
Right.
No, I don't have any money.
Wow.
But yet, Joe worked, his missus worked, the children worked after school and on weekends. The whole family worked the field for a right. whole year and didn't receive a penny. We have a brother in a very large mega carrier that we're getting ready to file a federal class action lawsuit on behalf of the company drivers and the owner ops that are leased on to the carrier. We have owner ops now. These are people that own the trucks.
Right.
They're working to buy the trucks. They make as little as $24 a week for 60, 70 hours a week. You have company drivers, and I'll give you a specific example. Driver got a ticket. Company refused to pay for the ticket, though the company was obligated to. The driver had to pay for the ticket. The ticket date came due. Driver was going to use his paycheck to pay for it, which he did. Unfortunately, the ticket was $300. His paycheck was $258.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me? Yeah. Let me, before we go too much further, before we started the tape rolling here on this podcast, you guys were talking quite a bit about the relationship with Canada and Mexico across borders of truckers. Can you tell us a little bit about how that got going, the international aspect? And is that an inspiration? Is that just part of the inspiration of the organizing effort to unite workers across borders? Is it opportunistic or is it principled? That's my really question.
It's part of the dream, but I'm going to let Jonas start to explain that since it was his efforts that led to that. And then if you don't mind, I'll jump in afterwards.
Okay.
Brother Jonah, go for it. You're the one that did it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because I'm still trying to gain a handle on how organized labor is kind of structured in Mexico, and I still don't quite understand that there's kind of a lot of different moving parts and various political interests and kind of different tensions between larger kind of over the road long haul truckers versus some of the smaller regional things. But I was really just inspired by reading about the early coal wars organizing and how closely tied the United Mine Workers and Mother Jones were to the Mexican miners unions. And a lot of people don't realize that there was actually a direct linkage between the coal mine wars that started the Mexican Revolution and the coal mine wars in West Virginia that really gave birth to the modern mine workers movement. Mother Jones actually traveled to Mexico a few times.
Wow, didn't know that.
And a large reason for that was because so many of the mines in Mexico were owned by gringo business people. And I kind of thought, you know, why why is this different in the trucking sector, especially with NAFTA? You know, I frequently hear in the Latin American labor movement, you know, the economy has globalized, so the struggle has to be globalized too. We can't stay confined to our national borders when all the goods that we produce and consume are now. So I started browsing the internet for any kind of news I could find about if there has been any kind of rumblings of labor organizing in long haul trucking, and frequently, time and time again, in various states in Mexico, I found, and I'm fluent in Spanish, I studied in southern Mexico for a semester in college. And so I was able to find a bunch of, just searching through the local newspapers, a bunch of reports of this group called Famexun, which is started by this guy in Tamaulipas. And their main tactic and their gripe is the refusal or sometimes outright complicity of the Mexican government and local authorities in allowing cartels to extort and kidnap truck drivers if they refuse to give up their cargo for ransom, the cartels. And their whole, I guess, motto or philosophy is, if the cartels organize blockades and stoppages on the highways to rob our drivers and the government is complicit, then we're going to stage our own blockades and make sure that the rest of the economy in these states can't function until the government actually gets their shit together and makes it so that driving in Mexico is a viable option. And so we got in touch with their leadership, and they seemed ecstatic to have contact with folks in North America frequently. I mean, there's numerous border crossings in Texas and California and Arizona that with NAFTA have become very busy with international shipments of especially auto parts, but also agriculture and various other important goods that we ship between the U.S. and Mexico. And they basically pledged their solidarity with us. They understand the nature of international trade and how it impacts the trucking industry. And while American truckers for now don't seem to face the same problems with corrupt police and cartel shakedowns, they are very well aware that our sectors are very connected. And although we might face different issues locally on the ground, you know, none of these industries will change unless we hit them where their pocketbook is. And for too long, organized labor has stayed in their silos of kind of nationalism that really allows these companies to exploit that and use other nationalities and production in other countries to undermine and undercut workers in their home countries. And our hope is with this international collaboration, we can put an end to that. And if we stage a work stoppage on the American side of the border, they'll support their end of the deal and vice versa. So we're still in our beginning stages, but we'll see where it's going to go. I think that's all I have to say about it. I don't know if you have anything to add, Billy.
I do a little bit. The solidarity pledged by both Temexum and Truckers Movement for Justice together is a shared vision. It's amazing how much we share and how our ideas and our vision is similar. We're getting to know the membership of Temexum and them us, and it's going to be a solid relationship between our two organizations. We are scheduled to send a delegation of Truckers Movement for Justice members to Mexico late summer to participate in a demonstration in Mexico City that'll be organized by Temexum. And at that point, we'll announce to the world that the two the two unions, the two labor organizations, have united as one with a pledge of unconditional solidarity north and south of the border. And we hope that somewhere in the near future, we'll be able to announce that Canadian truck drivers, or at least a portion of them, will also unite with the vision of a movement like this. And I'll add to something to what Jonah was saying. The mega carriers based in the United States, like CR England, Swift, Landstar, and all of the other carriers, have operations in Canada and Mexico. The brokerage firms also have operations globally. In fact, in the global sector, companies like C.H. Robinson, Total Quality Logistics, and many others, they're global in nature. They move from a factory in China goods to a facility in Mexico to a facility in the United States or Canada or El Salvador. These goods are controlled, whether steamship lines, rail lines, trucking companies, these are controlled by very, very few individuals. In fact, the largest marine terminal operator in North America, Ports America, is owned by the Canadian federal government through the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board. And it is particularly a target of Truckers Movement for Justice because of its mismanagement of marine terminal operations across the United States and the way drivers sit for up to 6 hours a day and don't get paid due to the fact that this corporation chooses not to hire enough longshore workers because longshore workers have to be paid. Well, the dumb truck drivers don't get paid for sitting on lines in ports like the Port of Baltimore or L.A. Long Beach or PNCT in New Jersey. They sit and wait and don't get paid. Well, what's best for my bottom line? Right. My bottom line says, don't hire more longshore workers. Let the truck drivers sit and wait.
So
it's all about greed and profit and corruption.
So let's. I just recently we watched the a national struggle with the railroad workers seeking an interesting kind of not the same but similar demands based on intolerable workloads and staffing, and the president imposed a settlement, and then 3 weeks later there was an explosion in Ohio. You're right, and we have a couple of good friends that are living right next to that. And, but my question really is that what's the what kind of reform is in the collective bargaining, including what's your attitude toward the Teamsters and the labor movement in general on this? Or are you seeking them to make certain changes? But beyond that, I mean, what's the regulatory reform agenda? Is there one yet that could resolve these issues, at least at on a national level, with a better framework? What's your thinking on both those questions?
Railroad Workers United, which is the cross-craft rank-and-file movement among rail union rank-and-file workers, is closely allied with Truckers Movement for Justice. They have initiated a call for public ownership of the rails, which we have stridently supported, and for communities and the workers affected by the decisions of the Class 1 rail carriers to be controlled by the very communities and workers that are involved in movement of rail freight. This issue of worker control, whether on a small scale like a timber hauling cooperative or port truckers banding together to affect a better way for the supply chain to work, or rail workers or longshore workers, is crucial to the organizing in the future to make these jobs sustainable. The rail carriers have cut back on hiring and working conditions so egregiously that no one even wants to work for the rails anymore. Rail used to be an excellent job. Families used to pass those jobs down to each other, just like in Longshore. Now, they're jobs that people hate to go to because of the workload and the working conditions, just like trucking. It's got to come to an end, and the only way it ends is when rank-and-file workers and their natural allies in their communities come together with a plan to change the way the supply line is, to take the greed and the corruption out of the supply line and place it back in the hands of the people who depend on the supply lines.
By the way, if
people... Warren Buffett doesn't depend on the supply line.
Yeah, he certainly does.
He owns the supply line.
He does. He likes hard stuff. He likes to... Yeah, he doesn't like the tech industry. But let me... It occurs to me that West Virginia subscribers to our podcast and listeners, how do they, if they're a truck driver and are they in trucking and they want to hook up with you guys, how do they do that?
They can do it. There are a number of ways, but the best way would be to contact, if you're in West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky and Western Pennsylvania, you can contact Jonah. We're leading an organizing campaign in West Virginia and the Eastern Kentucky coal fields now among the coal truck drivers for better working conditions and safer working conditions. Jonah, you want to give your number or your email address?
You guys don't have a web page?
We have not gotten that far along in our tech work yet. We do have a Facebook page, which is Truckers Movement for Justice.
Okay.
It's a public page.
Does it have a way to... I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, say that again.
No, does it have a way to contact you? So
it does, but I'll also give it if it's all right. You can reach us via cell phone at 845-768-0416. Or it's solidarity0501@gmail.com. Jonah, you want to give up your info as well?
If you could put it in the chat, because what I'm going to do is I publish a web page with every one of these podcasts, and I will include a link or a contact info in the web page. So if you could put it in the chat on Zoom here, Jonah. I don't think. I don't think Billy.
Yeah, Joan. I think you're going to have to do that because I'm via phone.
Yeah, you're by phone, and
just put it in the chat. We're all good.
Yeah, just put it in the chat, and then I'll put on the bottom of the when you post the podcast, I'll do the put in this so people have a way to get a hold of you guys. You know, for example, I mean, my one of the things we're planning on doing here, you know, both JB and I are connected to the Central Liberal Council here in this part of the state. So we were actually going to plan on hang out in front of the Amazon warehouses and, broadcasting. because the warehouse thing along I-81 here is just huge. We've got three of them now. And so I'd like to be able to hook them up with you guys if we get contacts and that kind of thing. So. Be good. As far as the irregular labor movement goes, I mean, the Teamsters Union obviously has got a long history in trucking. What's you have a relationship with the Teamsters, or is there a reform in mind, or I don't know. What's going on with labor, a little bit of labor politics?
We have rank and file Teamsters in TMJ, as well as some local officers from different locals that are part of TMJ. One of our national organizers is a rank and file Teamster on the West Coast. And we are one of our inactive members from the New England area is very close with Sean O'Brien, the new leader of the Teamsters elected on a reform slate. we hope we will be able to work with the Teamsters more in the future, but we really don't see the Teamsters doing much when it comes to over-the-road trucking and even regional areas. They've been removed from the industry for so many years now. There's a hard anti-union edge among truck drivers because they lack knowledge about what a union is, and they view traditional unions as not being very competent, as we say, or aggressive in their approach to industry. This can't be done in a traditional organizing model. This has to be done on the ground by individuals and small groups. You can't take down a whole industry just thinking you can announce plans like the unions did when right around the time of Bessemer with the Amazon workers vote down there. You can't take down an industry like this from the top down. It has to be done from the ground up by the rank and file worker involved, the grassroots effort. And I don't think traditional unions and their organizing model would ever work. It didn't. It hasn't for decades, for more than a generation, in fact, except here and there. Yeah. Harken back to the days of the industrial workers of the world in the early part of last century, and then later the CIO movement in the 30s and 40s. These were industrial efforts. They didn't target necessarily a specific company. They targeted industries at large. The steel workers in 1919 under William Foster struck the industry. It didn't strike U.S. Steel. It struck an entire industry. The IWW prior to that in the textile and silk mills on the eastern seaboard and on the west coast in the heavy metal mines and in lumber, it targeted the industry.
Right.
This is what we're hearkening back to. We're going back to our roots. We're targeting an entire industry. I don't give a damn if you work for Swift. I don't care if you work for Joe's Coal and Excavating.
Mm-hmm.
We're targeting an industry at large. All right. If we organize and successfully do it, it's going to be an industrial-wide contract agreement, okay, encompassing minimum standards to set in all areas. And yes, the coal truck drivers have different issues than the West Texas oil field drivers, than the reefer drivers that run South Florida. All of those can be modified with local amendments to a national agreement to affect things. A flatbed truck driver has different issues than a dry van driver. Logging has different issues on the ground than oil field drivers. And yet, across the entire transportation industry, the issues are similar and same. The issue of not being paid for all of our time, the issues of brokers and large carriers robbing wages through lack of transparency on the shipper's bill of freight, the lack of uniform home time where drivers can be home. And I don't mean for just 34-hour reset. I'm talking about substantial home time. Right. We call for 10 days on the road, 4 days at home.
Interesting. Okay.
This gives you an opportunity to have some time with your family and with your friends.
Absolutely.
And to do things around. 34 hours at home, when you get home, you're so exhausted, you crash. The next day, what do you turn around when you wake up? You have to be out the following night, so you turn around, oh, my God, I got to do laundry.
Yep.
Oh, but the kids have a baseball game or a game they want to or a soccer game they want to go to.
Yeah.
I got to do laundry, honey. I can't do it.
Right.
What about the single parent that's coming home to their children who are being watched by family members? They crash right. when they get home.
Yeah.
They're only got 34 hours. In that 34 hours, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to sleep most of it because you're exhausted.
Right.
This is not home time. This is not quality of life. To use the words of Brother Hugh Sawyer from Railroad Workers United at a meeting in Chicago during the Labor Notes Conference last year. Billy, it's about quality of life for all of us. That's what we're fighting for.
I got one other question. Go ahead. Hold on a second. I want you to a couple more things before with you. We got about 10 minutes. I don't like podcasts to go much more than 45 minutes. But one question is, it's two questions. One is the gig worker. There are a lot of similarities between an owner-operator in some situations and the gig worker phenomenon, which is spreading just like wildfire everywhere, and the new AI technologies and all that are only going to aggravate that. So an approach to gig workers, and two, the role of racism to the extent that it is active amongst the workers that you're organizing, and your approach to that question.
The issue of racism and anti-immigration are extensive in transportation industry. You will hear workers from all nations criticize workers of other nations and say that it's immigrant workers' fault that the rates and the wages are down. It's a divide and conquer in the classic form. Workers are blaming other workers for their own working conditions instead of seeking to build solidarity with each other. I'll give you an example, two examples actually. Truckers that run drayage freight out of the ports blame the longshore workers for their wait times. They say the longshore workers are union workers, so they're lazy. What about management? Oh, management don't have anything to do with it. The longshore workers control the docks. Really? Don't you think management is laughing at both of you? What would happen if you both united? What would happen if they were forced to pay truck drivers for their waiting time? We saw it in the Port of Baltimore last year. They moved five steamship lines offshore. They refused to unload the boxes on five of the biggest container companies in the world. Why? Because 24 drivers struck the port, demanding all hours worked for all hours paid. They hired more longshore workers, and the drivers that ran into the port and out of it had a bonanza. They showed it can be done.
Wow.
It's simple economics. Another example. It's this group of workers that are in the industry now, and they don't know anything about the industry, so they're taking rates. They're driving down rates for all of us. No, they're not driving down rates for all of us. Remember how we all started. We all started trying to make a living. Some of us wanted to be small business people. Some of us were company drivers. And we accepted what the industry gave us. What happens if we united together and fought back against the industry to establish standards for the industry, a national agreement? Oh, maybe then we wouldn't have to worry about driving down standards because we'd have an agreement that was enforced legally and collectively. Jonah, you want to chime in on either one of those?
Or especially the gig worker issue too, what kind of agreement can cover a gig worker? But the job, it's a big problem.
Traditional unions have tried to organize gig workers in New York State and I believe in a couple of other states, but what little I know about it, what I've seen is they're ramming down standards down the workers' throats without the workers having any say in it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And quite honestly, that's bullshit. And all you're doing is creating hostility by potential union workers and organized workers against you. I know in some cases in the taxi industry in New York, rank and file groups have sprung up to organize, to try to establish standards, much the way TMJ is doing and others, and they've had some success. But once again, it's not following the traditional approach of organized labor. Mm-hmm. It's using creative ideas based on workers' own experience, knowledge, and coming together with other workers to effect change. This is the way change comes. It comes from the ground up, not from the top down.
Amen. Well, Jonah, we're at the, I think we're right close to the witching hour here. We got about a minute before we hit the 45-minute mark. You want to get any closing thoughts on the matter?
No, I don't think so. We just got reached out to by a coal truck driver out of Beckley who doesn't, I think they might have gotten cold feet and didn't want to come on due to workplace issues and fear of retaliation. But
right.
I think to the topic of what Billy was mentioning with, you know, the current organizing approach doesn't work. But most strong unions that we still see today that have some sort of a presence, especially in states that are anti-labor, did not use those strategies to get to where they are, especially the United Mine Workers adopted the old strategies of the CIO and the IWW. And that's where, I mean, that driver who reached out to us a few days ago in Beckley used to be part of the United Mine Workers and was very explicit about the desire to see that kind of organizing happen. So right. I think there is a potential to kind of resuscitate some of that, you know, knowledge and collective conscience that we see in Southern West Virginia, mm-hmm. where people have grown disillusioned with where organized labor is now, but they're not necessarily opposed to the idea of it in general. And I think that's kind of where the right. you know, the kind of semantic warfare comes in, where people get, you think they're anti-labor, but they're not. And,
you know, well, I think you're right.
Actually, get people the goods. That's
well. I want to thank. I want to thank you. I want to thank Jonah and Billy, both of you, for coming on. We're going to try to circulate this as widely as possible and develop some interest in your movement. I will just say amen to both of your remarks. You know, the biggest treat at the West Virginia AFL-CIO state gatherings is when we Cecil Roberts and his color guard, I'll call him, arrives on the scene. And of course, Cecil's an old timer of the First Order. I mean, when he starts doing one of his walking up and down the aisles and, you know, quoting Mother Jones on one hand and Dr. King on the other and looking you straight in the eye and you cannot look away. And his the leadership of the union that comes with him are dressed in colors. They're in uniform, and they are one. And that makes a big impression. I remember I was talking to a bunch of Amazon workers, actually in North Carolina. and, you know, I recommended that they were thinking about going it alone and doing their own thing. I said, well, you give the mine workers a look. Yeah, well, what do they have to do with warehouses? I says, there's one thing the mine workers understand, and that is solidarity. And
yes, they do.
They understand that, and you're going to need that before you need anything else. So anyway,
and I might add that we are looking forward through the efforts of Brother Jonah and others of working very closely with the UMWA in the coal fields right. to effect change both for drivers as well as for coal miners, and maybe even build a resurgence. All right, among truckers and mine workers in the near future. We welcome solidarity from all parts of organized labor, be they traditional or not. The mine workers, the ILWU, the UE, are all unions of with a strong history of solidarity and rank and file efforts. And I might throw in the industrial workers of the world as well, since we have many Wobblies that are part of TMJ as well.
Amen. All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll be in touch. Bye-bye.
Great. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Good day.